I think the first thing I'd like to do tonight, just it's sort of an aside, but I'd like to look at that second psalm that we mentioned this morning. I think it is a lot of comfort in it for us in this day of very devastating events taking place around the world, and despotisms of various kinds, despotic rulers, bellicose, meaning warlike, uttering bellicose and belligerent proclamations. There are a fairly limited number of people in high places that are keeping the entire world turned upside down. Not very many. You might count on, at least two hands. If you're not a carpenter and you've ran into a saw somewhere, you can count on a couple of hands at least the rulers in the world that are really keeping the entire world upset, distorted. Of course, they have underlings and so forth, but they're the if they were out of the picture, the world would be more or less at peace. But let's just look at this. I just decided to do that. I didn't bring the Hebrew text to read it from that, but I just read it from the English. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. So there's sort of a ascending degree of God's wrath against these people. He's going to laugh, and he's going to have them in derision, and then he's going to vex them, that is, trouble them. The Hebrew word means to trouble them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord hath said unto me, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron, thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, that is, make peace with the Son, lest he be angry and you perish from the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him. You see, we can also share the Lord's the sense that he is going to overcome them. He laughs at them in his own way, you see. They think that they're going to overcome the world, and they're going to do their great things to the earth. They're going to exercise power, and they're really a tempest in a teapot. Now, it's hard on the people who live on the earth, but as far as God is concerned, he has everything under control, you see. Just think of that. God shall laugh at them, have them in derision. And that should give you some sense of comfort. But as I said, it's in the realm of the spirit that we come into. That is, it's while on the earth, we still have the distresses of our earthly vessels to contend with. But the end is going to be victorious, and that we can bank on. We can trust the Lord to keep things in his hand, to do what he's going to do. All right, now I'm going on to the 31st Proverbs, 31st chapter, and sort of wrap up what we've been talking about for several weeks here. Because this is part of Solomon's message. It's particular section, probably not written by Solomon himself, but It's in that, in the book of Proverbs, which we've been studying, and this is the last of it, and I feel like we ought to deal with this passage, which has to do with the so-called virtuous woman. Now, the issue of womanhood in the world, the so-called women's lib movement, the now movement, and so forth, have caused a lot of unsettledness in the issue of the relationship between the man and the woman, the roles of male and female in the world. And Christians are disturbed by this, don't know where their own position ought to lie in this. And I think a lot of times people are uneasy because they don't want to violate some commandment of God. That causes a lot of distress. And oftentimes husbands have a problem with their wives because they really feel that they're out of the will of the Lord if they don't hold the reins pretty tight. And so these are very valid questions. And of course, there are a lot of people that are not married that have the same issue of what is the role of the male or the female in our society. And I think ultimately what I'd like to end up with is an attitude of peace about it, that is some sense of confidence that one is integrated with what is taking place in the world as far as woman is concerned, because there's a great sort of a mass movement to press the claims of women. So we laid a lot of groundwork here on the basis that there's no use to talk about the subject at all unless one is concerned to do what the Lord wants. That's the whole thing. If a person's out for their own ends, there's not much that we have to say about that here. In the matter of husbands and wives, if each one of the couple is strictly interested in getting their own way, then you're going to have trouble. Now, the passage in Proverbs gives us quite a lot of latitude here that I would like to sort of square up with what is taking place today and what Christian's attitude ought to be toward these things. And let me read then again the passage in Proverbs 31, verse 10. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. She shall do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She bringeth her food from afar. She riseth also while it is yet night and giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field and buyeth it. With the fruit of her hand she planteth a vineyard. But she girdeth her loins with strength and strengtheneth her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Her candle goeth not out by night. She layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor, yea, she reacheth forth her hand to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. She maketh fine linen and selleth it, and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Now, obviously, this is Supermom. And I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that that is the criterion for womanhood, you know, that, because I think if a young man would set that out as the criterion for the girl he would marry, he would remain celibate all his life, and should, if you're going to put that on it. But what it does do for us is give us the parameters of the issue in a very clear way, clearer than we may see it in the New Testament, even though it's not counter to anything in the New Testament. Again, I have to say to you, I'm using the word parameters because it has now, as a matter of usage, been brought over into the social science field. But I'm well aware, since it is a new application of the word, I'm well aware that it formerly was only applied correctly to mathematics. But parameters is very much like word perimeter or limits. Limits, that's the way it's used in social science. The parameters of the problem mean to us, but not to the mathematician, means to the social scientist, the implications of a whole orb of the problem. And so this gives us the parameters. And what it suggests to us is, first of all, and most importantly, that the woman is a person in her own right. Now that, gentlemen, is a very crucial point in the whole discussion. What a woman is concerned about is that she be, shall I say, swallowed up in the situation so that she has no identity. And that's what is a constant problem. And she may overreact in issues because of being afraid of that, of having no personal identity, but only being a tag-along, shall we say, of the male. Now, if the husband sees her in the light of, or even those she works with, let's broaden it, because we're not going to just talk about husbands and wives per se, but about the whole problem of the role of women in society. What limits are they justified in going to or striving in terms of personal identity? And if we might make the first point, I don't usually give points, but if we might make the first point, the issue of wanting to do what Christ wants in the matter. A woman that is open to Christ and not out just for herself will find her area with a greater understanding than the woman that is simply out to prove that women are as good as men. Although basically the woman who wants to be like a man is stepping down. If a man may have more opportunities in the world, I think in many respects the man has limits that diminish the woman if she wants to occupy that role as a man. So the point for a Christian woman simply is, what does the Lord want out of my life? So that's point one. But point two is, the woman wants to be and needs to be seen as a person, an individual within herself, and not simply as an adjunct, where the husband or the workforce around her or her associates recognize her as an individual, as her own person, then she'll be more at peace and more content about these things. But as I say, it's the idea that she's being swallowed up. The woman who handles the home has got to be very, very clever. Has a lot of characteristics and qualities that the man probably doesn't have. I don't think the average male could handle the home situation in the same way that a woman can. Something in her basic makeup that allows her to survive in that milieu, and I think it's a gift of God. But remember the vital point that I have made all along, that the shaping of children is a work of art in the same way that a sculpture is a work of art. It's a creative work of art. No one would suggest, for example, let's take Michelangelo, who painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And he is more perhaps widely known than most artists, so that's why I select him. Michelangelo was an artist in his own right. No one would have classed him as an aid to the painters of the Sistine Chapel, or submerged him in the work of the painter. And, you know, if they were taking tours through the Sistine Chapel, and people said, well, that area there was painted by Michelangelo, and this area over here was painted by Giulini or something, you see. Making no difference between the people that painted the walls and Michelangelo, or saying they're all, Michelangelo helped out a little bit here. He covered a little area up there on the roof, on the ceiling. that would be totally ignoring his creativity and handiwork. And I think in a very special way, women have a place of creative sculpturing of the family, of children. And they have probably more to do with that than the husbands who are away all day. The sculpturing of a child, the creative task that goes into raising a family is all a challenge anybody ever needs. And remember the words of, I forgot who said it, but I've quoted often, stone walls do not a prison make or iron bars a cage. A person is caged only if they think they're caged. Let us say now that someone is working on some highly sensitive project for NASA, a space probe, and they go into this same room day in and day out, and they're so intensely at their work that they're there 10, 11, 12 hours a day. Someone could say to them, why are you caged in there? Why are you cooped up in that room? Why don't you get out and do something? Go into gardening or something, because then you don't have any walls around you. If we think we're caged, I guess. But if we see ourselves as an individual with a private gift from God, nobody else is like us. We are individuals. We have a task to do. If you're doing what you think the Lord wants you to do, whether you are pounding a typewriter or running a computer or raising children, if you're doing what you believe the Lord wants you to do, you're free. You see, you're free. It's only that people get talked into a cage. I hear some of the comments made over radio and television from the would-be psychologist or pseudo-psychologist, or whatever we might call them. And I think to myself, here is such total insensitivity to what a human being is. It is astounding to me that somebody wants to take authority or responsibility. Someone would take responsibility to upset another person's life. You have a young woman, for example, who has married happily, and she's content with her situation and going along fine. Then people around her, including the television moguls and nitwits and so on, are trying to persuade her that she's not happy and that this is a terrible... If you are happy, you're psychotic. That's the... Or neurotic. That's the general approach, not only of television and radio, but family members, sisters and mothers and church members and so forth are chanting the same song that the godless psychologists are chanting, and the sociologists, and the women's libbers are chanting. Now, I remember I've said to you from the beginning that there are unusual circumstances. I'm well aware of that. But the general pattern that I'm trying to get across to you is, whether you are in the home or out of the home, the issue is what does the Lord want you to do and not what does someone out there in the world think that you ought to do. In fact, it would be surprising to you to know the depth of despair and the despicable circumstances of some of the great artists of the world in the fine arts. I'm talking about music and oil or painting and so forth. And how often they were ridiculed and put down, and how many times the old chant, why don't you do something useful instead of sitting at this piano banging on the keys all day, you see. So someone like a Beethoven might have been sent out to bake bread or something, and the world be bereft of his music. Or Toulouse-Lautrec, for example, is one of the great examples of the artist that was belittled and put down and terribly mistreated. A lot of it because of his very short stature, based upon an accident that he had, and he didn't develop properly. And but he was one of the great artists of the world today. But if you went through people, you know, the great artists of the world who were maligned because of their applying their craft, you see, their art, instead of going out and doing something useful. So no one outside of you really knows what you ought to do or who you are. Only Christ knows that. But don't let someone else shape your life by telling you what you ought to like or ought not to like, by trying to judge you by what you feel fulfilled in. So instead of letting them say to you, well, if you feel fulfilled as a housewife, you must be a very, very simple person. And that's just totally absurd. It's a failure to understand the whole thing. It, what it really reflects is the leaders of the Lib movement have never understood the meaning of family. They've been perhaps from the beginning out for themselves. Now, of course, the leaders of the women's movement, by the very fact that they are in a position to talk to other women, reflect that they have certain capacities for public activity that not everybody has. In other words, you can't, where they're tempting or enticing these women to go out of their workaday, their drudgery life in the home and go out into careers, a lot of those women, maybe 90% of them, are not going to wind up in some exciting fulfillment kind of career. And yet they've been enticed out into the world with their model, their role model, are these exciting, in their words, quote, exciting, vivacious career women that are the spokespersons for the women's movement, you see. Same thing happens in the church. The people that are planning the programs are all automatically leaders to begin with, or they wouldn't be in a position to plan the program. And they assume that everybody out there has got to have the talents they have, that everybody ought to be a leader and a spokesperson and ought to be out witnessing and all this sort of thing, as though everybody were a mouth. And sometimes their mouth is a little too big, I think, for their own good. You see, there's a principle established here that fulfillment of yourself has to do with whatever it is that Christ has brought you into. And I don't think anyone can really tell you that but yourself, with the point made that if marriage is something you have the privilege of being involved in, and you have children, there's no greater way to fulfill yourself as a person than sculpting these children, raising a family, directing them, guiding them, shaping them, and to hand them over to an amateur of some kind, or at least to somebody who doesn't know them as you know them, just some casual person, would be, again, like Michelangelo handing his brushes to one of the sentinels down on the Swiss Guard, let us say, at the Vatican. He hands his brushes to the Swiss Guard as he runs off to become a gardener. That's the essence of it. Now, the parameters of this situation in Proverbs indicate that this woman... I have to say, this is extremely supermom type here, because it has her doing all of these things that it take four or five people to do. But she's involved in merchandising. She is involved in the merchant ships. That is, she goes and sells things. She maketh fine linen and selleth it, delivereth girdles unto the merchant, and so forth. And earlier, she buys a field. In this particular case, she plants a vineyard. Now, be no different in buying a field and selling that. I presume if she can make or buy, planting a field and selling wine. Lydia, who was the essence of the prime mover of the Philippian church, and Paul went over to Philippi from Troas. There he went down to the river and met this woman, the seller of purple. Now, what that, of course, obviously would mean is a seller of cloth. And purple cloth was of high value to royalty and aristocracy and so forth. But she was not just a five-and-dime clerk. She was a merchantess. She was a proprietress of a business entity which had to do with trafficking in goods, in cloth. Maybe only purple, maybe that was just a symbolic for many but different kinds of cloth. So what do we have here? We have a woman in a place of merchandising and business, regarded in that position very, very highly. I think the women in this world today that are in those positions graciously, you see, instead of out there clawing away at the men, they're doing what they believe they're qualified to do and working at it quietly and letting their own talent handle their situation. There are a lot of women in the world that completely without any help from, I'm not going to mention names here, but from various women's livers, completely without any help from them, have risen to places of great prominence. In fact, many of the world's rulers have been women. Catherine the Great, although some of them do have a slightly tainted reputation, but we'll just overlook that for the moment and say they were in position of power. But Catherine the Great, and to mention one of the prominent ones, and of course, Golda Meir, prominently known to us, and people in our own government long before the women's lib movement ever came along, Clare Booth Luce, Jean Kirkpatrick now, one of the very most capable people we've had in the task of ambassador to the United Nations. So you see, we can't really drive stakes here in terms of provincial regulations as far as what a woman has the capacity to do. Because throughout the Bible, women have been in places of capacity. Now, where limits are drawn, which we can successfully and acceptably draw from statements in the Scripture, have to do with a woman being in a position of being a doctrinaire teacher of the Word or of men. In other words, the Bible is rather explicit about a woman being a theologian and running the church, so to speak. Although there are many examples of women who were important in the church, and I'm sure in God's eyes as important as any man. You have Priscilla, for example, notably in the New Testament, the wife of Aquila, who, it said in one point, along with Aquila, took Apollos aside and taught him Apollo and taught him the way of God more perfectly. He was apparently lacking in some understanding of the work that had been done through the apostles and Pentecost. She was in that position, and I don't think that we can limit the idea of the ministry of a woman to not open her mouth, you know, to not speak. And I think that women have a great place of ministry, but not as ultimate leaders of the church, not to control the church or to be the developers of theology. There are specifics there, but also as far as the home is concerned, the scripture is very clear about Eve's creation as a helper for Adam, but that did not necessarily mean that she was a servant. It certainly didn't mean that she was his servant. She was his helper. She was his aid, his assistant. It doesn't even mean she was inferior to him at all. Here was Adam already created. God raised up Eve to help him. They worked together. And so women have qualities that complement men. That is, or vice versa. We have qualities as a male and qualities as a female that are complementary so that they work best as a team. When you have a male without a female assistant, he may tend to get a little too harsh, a little too insensitive without the assistance of a woman. But it doesn't have anything to do with inferiority. It has to do only with role, or with the fact that you have two people working together. Now, Paul apparently gives in the book of 1 Corinthians, in the 11th chapter, the ultimate headship to the husband in terms of the last word of authority in, as to what the family is going to do. Now, there has to be some speculation here, but the nature of the context is, as God is the head of Christ, so Christ is the head of the man, and the man the head of the woman. That's the way it works. So Christ is submissive to God in role. Now, obviously, Christ is not inferior to God, but submissive in role. The husband is submissive to Christ in his role. The wife is submissive to the husband as the representative of Christ. Theoretically, the husband's headship relates to matters of, especially the spirit. That's primary. Let us put it a little differently and say that, again, theoretically, the headship of the man over the wife would be in the areas where Christ would be expected to be head over the man. That's you can't have Christ telling him what color of socks to buy, for example. I suppose if a fellow wanted to ask direction, he could get it. I don't know. I haven't asked the Lord yet what color of socks I should buy. But I might have asked for guidance relative to a suit of clothes, for example. I've been guided to purchase suits of clothes. But what I'm saying is the husband's role over the wife is not to tell her what colors of clothes to wear, what... You know, her private life in that respect is not an area that he ought to get involved in, or how to run the household, as how to vacuum the floors or do the ironing or whatever. And not, all those things are not things that he has jurisdiction over. But if it's a matter of what city do we move to, what job does he take, so forth, those are matters that he has an ultimate authority, and whatever affects the overall welfare of the family would be what he has ultimate authority in. But a lot of husbands have missed this by being despots over every aspect of their of the life of their wife. One of the psychological enigmas of our time has to do with the role of the husband in helping to take care of the babies. So, for example, over television commercials, you find daddy down on the floor talking about the baby's fit of the baby's diapers and how sweet our little lady is, and so forth. So it's a very unpleasant commercial as far as I'm concerned. But I think one of the problems is that what is not recognized is that at the same time they are taking away from the woman a uniqueness that she has up to this time enjoyed, that is, as being more capable of taking care of the children than the men. You rob her of her own expertise. She may not recognize that point, but and the psychologists seem not to think about that, but it really cuts the woman down a little by saying, oh, well, that's nothing, I can do the same thing. I'll just pop home from the office and change the baby's diapers or whatever. Nothing wrong with males changing the baby's diapers. But I mean, if she feels, he says, move over, Mama, I know as much about it as you do, would be like her going to the office you know, anybody can do this job. Well, move over, I want to dictate the next set of letters for you. You know, it's sort of that idea. Anybody can do it. I can do it with one hand tied behind me. It's a put-down to the woman. She may not even recognize at this point that she is losing a certain area of uniqueness and expertise that she has. But again, it doesn't say a husband should never change a diaper or take care of a baby, but it's the feeling that he's just as good as she is at it. Which is not true. Basically, psychologically, although there are always exceptions to these things, but basically and psychologically, a woman is more capable of taking care of children than a man. In terms of what a woman has the capacity to do, or what she, what career she may follow, there are some very broad parameters here that the Bible allows. If a woman wants to know what is my role, what can I do, I'm going to say, just talk to the Lord about it and see where He leads you in it. And I think that's why some women do resent their situation in the home, because they have husbands who tend to put them in that kind of a position of a servant. But they have to recognize their contribution is equally important as the male who may be out earning a living altogether. And for the man to say, for example, well, it's my money, I earned it, I have a right to spend it the way I want, is idiocy, total idiocy, because while he's out making the dollars in the marketplace, she's making it possible for him to do that by taking care of things at home. I mean, they're a team. I don't suppose there's any reason even to discuss it, because of its obvious truth. But there again is a matter of the woman seeing her position as a wife, not as a servant, but as a part of the family of Christ, as a an agent of Christ in the homemaking. See, she has to see herself as an entity. And then probably the third thing is that she has to be really submissive to Christ in terms of accepting the role that He's given her and being at peace about it, the role that she has. If she thinks it ought to be changed, she can pray and ask Him to help her change it, to find a new way.